everyone, welcome back to the UK's number one retro gaming podcast, The Retro Asylum. This is episode 15. I'm your host, Andy Godoy, and joining me today is Colin Jones.
Hello there.
How are you doing, Colin?
I'm very good, thanks. How are yourself?
Not too bad. So first of all, I'd like to thank you for actually agreeing to do this. It really means a lot, and I'm sure our community from the Retro Asylum are really looking forward to this.
Pleasure.
Right, so let's find out. Let's go right back down to the beginning then, Colin. We want to know about the gaming. So what was your first memory of gaming?
Well, that's an interesting question because I was actually doing a timeline for my website this week. Mm-hmm. And what I realized was I was quite fortunate in that I think my comprehensive school was the first, certainly in Wales, to do computer science or computer studies as a subject, which meant that not only did we know of the existence of mainframes, etc., and we're going back to the early 70s now, mm-hmm. but we actually got to program in BASIC, we got to write programs onto punch tape, and then there was a little device in the back of the classroom where we could feed in the computer tape and it would get sent down the phone line into a huge mainframe computer.
Wow.
Which would take an age, and then you'd wait half an hour for that to go through. You'd book a time slice, I think the term was, and you'd wait for the program to run, and then, of course, you'd get to line 36 error, syntax error.
Oh,
but
no.
That was interesting because it opened it up for me, and I just saw it as another medium.
Yeah. Was this something that you thought you really took well to, and you thought you'd definitely give it a go? Or was that a little bit later? Were you inspired by the arcades of the days or other programmers of the day?
Yeah, at the time, programming was programming. I can't remember computer games when I was in school, basically. Mm-hmm. Space Invaders, I think, probably was the first. No, actually, Pong. I did play Pong at my cousin's house. She had one of the early computer games. So I knew of the existence of computer games, but I don't think I really connected programming with entertainment, if you like.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until somewhere in the early 80s where I got to play on a Texas Instruments games console over a friend's house. And it suddenly hit me that I could move a joystick, and it seems strange now because it's so commonplace, but you could move a joystick and a cartoon character, or albeit a very basic cartoon character, would move about on screen. And the possibilities began to open up, if you like, that you could actually have storylines that you could change, etc., etc., comics. You could have music that could change even. I can't say I thought of all that at the time, mm-hmm. but that was the moment where everything came together, and the ZX Spectrum had just come out, I believe. So I saved up my money and took the leap into it and started programming Spectrum games.
So what was your opinion on the Spectrum then? So when you first got it, you know, what were you like when you got it?
It was quite magical. You could do things that nobody had done before. Looking back, of course, it seems very primitive with the graphics and the sound were very limited, but you just had the opportunity to play with it, and it was the power had been given over to you, if you like. It had been democratized. You could do stuff that people had never done before.
No, it was a great little system, the Spectrum, and loads of bedroom programmers started back in the day.
Yeah.
And it also celebrated its 30th birthday just a few weeks ago.
Yes, it did. Yes, I must dig mine out.
Oh. Right, so moving on to the next question then. So at which point did you first start working on your first game then?
It was probably a couple of weeks after seeing the Texas Instruments games console. It was that quick, really. I just had to do it. I'm not sure if you could buy them in shops or if you had to. Sinclair products were probably postal, weren't they?
Yeah.
Probably had to send off. I know I did. I went out on a limb and I did go for the 48K model. I thought that would stand me in good stead, as it did. And then I must have got a book on machine code and typed in hexadecimal numbers, which is a strange thing to do, but a harmless hobby. And then I seem to think I took about a month to write the first computer game, and I just thought I'll send this off to, I'll find a software company and I'll send it off. What I didn't realize at the time was this was becoming quite a lucrative market for people that the first company that I sent it to, Arctic Computing, said, yeah, that we'll release it for Christmas.
So what sort of preparation did you do for this game, and what was the name of this game?
Well, the game was called I'm in Shock, and looking back on it, I think it's got one screen. I don't think the screen changed it at all. And it's basically a Space Invaders type game with small reflective triangles which change the path of missiles. It's nothing to write home about, basically, but I was in the right place at the right time.
So what was the feedback from Arctic about this game then? Did you hear about them straight away, about the game itself? What did they say about it?
There was pretty much no feedback except, from what I can remember, a contract in the post. I can't remember changing anything. I don't believe it had a loading screen even. I don't think they even wanted to put a loading screen. From what I can imagine looking back, it must have just arrived at the right time. They had product, that, or they didn't have, perhaps they had a gap in their Christmas product, and they wanted to get it out there. So the feedback was, yeah, we'll release it, we'll sign the contract, and we'll get it out, which they did. And they sent me royalties.
Right, so were you impressed with what you got there? Did that make you think, I could actually do more on this? I could make another game?
Yes. I was, I guess, a little stunned and foolishly thought, yes, I'll write another game. I had no contact with other people as such. Nobody would say, that's a good idea, that's a bad idea. These were in the days where people weren't connected. So I just wrote the next game, which was probably Salmo, I think, which took a couple of years to get released. In the meantime, I started falling in with other people.
Right.
I think I'd written probably the third game I wrote was an adventure, a text adventure, written with the Quill adventure system, which did the job. It was text only. Mm-hmm. But I wrote a quirky little adventure called Paradise in Microdot, which no one will remember because it eventually got pushed out on Automata's 10-pack
series.
But that got me into contact because it was a sort of a strangely humorous adventure. That appealed to Mel at Automata, and we struck up a friendship and a working relationship then, which is still to this day.
Now, I'm looking at the loading screen there of Paradise in Microdot, and it's got a funny-looking character there with glasses and his hair sticking up there.
It does
look like a really interesting game, actually. I might have to try and get that one from World of Spectrum. So what sort of preparations did you do for these games? I mean, how did you go about coming out with the idea and actually putting them, you know, onto the Spectrum? How did you do that?
Yeah, I think I'd had a good grounding between my school days and the computer days. I'd studied architecture at university.
Right.
Which was very good for designing environments. And I looked at the adventure game as a series of rooms, which it is, a series of rooms, but I had some sort of idea about how you should be able to move through different locations.
Yeah.
And then I think what I did with Paradise in Microdot, which I later did in Rockstar, was I just wanted to keep myself happy because it was still it's still a fairly long process writing a game. By that time, I'd probably gone into 2 months writing a game, and you just wanted to stick a few jokes in, basically, to keep yourself sane.
Now, at the time, you were currently just writing the games yourself, is that correct?
Yes. Which was a foolish thing to do looking back, but it was the only thing. It was what I had to do, basically, because there was no other way of getting them out.
Right, so let's move on to what was the next game that you made then, Colin?
I think by that time, there was probably another game which, again, took ages. What I started finding was that people were reluctant to release games that I'd written without any prior consultation. They wanted some sort of... They wanted to get involved in it in a certain way. So through Paradise in Microdot, then I seem to remember being offered the Commodore 64 version of Deus Ex Machina.
Oh, okay.
Which was horrific to program because it was something like 10 mini games. Mm-hmm. I had no idea about programming, really. I didn't know you should really use the same program and put different bits of data in it.
Yeah.
I'd write these 10 little sequences and wonder why they didn't fit in a Commodore 64. So that took a while to finish. I think that missed the deadline. But it did come out, and it looks good on the CV.
How do you compare then the C64 programming compared to the ZX Spectrum then? What are the main differences? What are the things you had problems with? What are the things you actually enjoyed?
The Commodore 64 would give you more choice with the graphics, I remember. It was strange that you traded off colour for resolution, as far as I can remember. You could have more colours on screen, but you'd have to halve your resolution.
Yeah.
Then you had sprites, which were a joy, of course. That was something that you'd have loved on the Spectrum, because you'd have got rid of all the colour clash problems.
Yeah. I think it's part of the charm that the Spectrum had with the colour clash there.
Yeah, yeah. The problem I had with Deus Ex Machina was getting the timing to work, because you probably remember that it was linked up to an audio cassette. And the games had to start and finish at certain points in the soundtrack. And for some reason, I couldn't, for the life of me, get the timing of the Commodore 64 right. And I got it pretty close in the end, but that was a big problem.
So at this point then, were you finding that games were taking you a lot longer to actually do than when you first began?
Yes. Yes. Deus Ex Machina was the first game, probably the first game where I had a deadline. And I guess everyone was making it up as they went along, and nobody really knew how long a deadline should be. In my defence, I'd say probably the deadline was out. I couldn't have worked any harder.
Yeah.
I remember working Christmas Eve.
Wow. So you really put a lot of time and dedication into that game.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, so we'll move on to the next game then, Colin. What was the next one you've done there? Let's have a look. Ah, I see you've got Grange Hill was possibly the next one on the ZX Spectrum.
Grange Hill, yes, that was fun. For some reason, the people at Argus Press Software decided that I should be allowed to write the Grange Hill video game.
So how did that come about? How did they choose you to actually do Grange Hill?
They were quite interesting people involved at the time. They seemed to pop up all over the shop. I think a lot of people thought that video games and computer games could be a new medium for doing very creative stuff. So there were people all over the place. I'd sent off a game which never got published, which was a sound game. And what was that called? Darkness at Dawn. That's right, Darkness at Dawn.
Right.
I sent that off to a number of publishing houses, and Argus Press got in contact through that. They said they loved the game. They didn't want to release the game, but they loved the game. But they had a project. Would I come up to London and discuss it with them? Which I did. Had a nice day out on the train. And to my surprise, they offered me Grange Hill, which was quite a big title at the time.
Were you familiar with the TV show at the time then?
Yes.
Did you watch it so you knew who the characters were, or was it just sprung upon you?
No, I think most people my age would have known Grange Hill. It was a good show, from what I remember. Written by Phil Redmond, the precursor to Brookside, the old soap opera.
So this must have been around the same time with the whole Grange Hill, when they released that song, Just Say No.
That's correct, yes.
And Zamo, if I'm correct.
Yeah, Gonch and Hollow. I was reading about this the other day, but on Wikipedia, there's a claim that the ending, well, a possible ending to Grange Hill is one of the darkest game overs ever.
Right,
because
okay.
you have to say no, basically, in the game, otherwise that's it.
So, okay, how long did it take you to actually program Grange Hill, and how did you go about doing it?
Yeah, I was... This is where I couldn't believe my luck, to be honest. I went up to Argus Press and said, I'd love to do Grange Hill, but I haven't really got the time to program it. And I thought, well, that's it then. I didn't know you could just design a game and not have to program it.
Yeah.
Nobody told me that. So, they said, well, that's all right. We'll get another company to do that. I took a month, which was a luxury. I took a whole month just to design the video game, the adventure game.
Yeah.
And then I didn't know what they expected of me. I thought they expected the puzzles and the location descriptions. I'd sketched a few backgrounds in, thinking that a graphic artist will improve on these later on. But what I didn't realise was that they seemed to take those sketches and take that as the final look for the game, which meant that the game looked a little starker than I'd imagined it. But there we are.
And I remember actually really enjoying this game back in the day because I used to watch Grain Chill. Mm-hmm. I grew up with it. So it was just really nice interacting with these characters on the TV screen.
Yeah, and we tied in. There was one particular Grain Chill paperback that I worked from, and I took a lot of the plot out of that, so it tied in nicely. I don't think it contradicted it in any way. I think it worked within the confines of the stories. I think it was not bad.
Now, earlier on you mentioned like it had one of the darkest endings. I never actually finished this game, and I'm not sure if some of our listeners have. Well, why don't you tell us about what actually happened at the end of the game and what led up to it?
Yes, well, you're walking along by a seedy canal, I think.
Right.
As is often the way, and a shadowy character emerges and offers to sell you a packet of powder.
Right.
And you have an option, I guess. The option must have been quite simply say yes or say no. I knew some people would have to press the yes button. And then I can read you the text now. I've got it here.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
You get the text screen. I'll try and be serious now. You get the text screen. There's an empty look in his eye as he snatches the money from your hand. His face is pale and drawn, his body thin and unfed. He steals to keep his habit and makes addicts of children. He is dead, and soon you will be too.
Pretty gripping stuff, actually. Pretty gripping stuff.
Over.
So what happened then if you did press no, that you didn't want to take the drugs off the character?
Oh, pretty much no, you'd carry on with the game. I don't think there was any sort of reward. No, you just carried on to the next location.
I bet you everyone must have pressed yes.
I guess so.
Everyone must have done that. Right, so what was the next big game that you worked on then, Colin?
That would probably have been ID, or ID, small I before our time, big D, with Mel Croucher. From what I remember, Automata UK had folded or dissolved or been disbanded by then.
Mm-hmm.
And Mel was working on a number of products, a number of things to take the games industry forward. And we co-worked on this. There was some involvement with Clement Chambers from CRL. I think he had the original idea of a computer intelligence that appeared one day in your Spectrum, and that you knew nothing about this intelligence, and you had to find out who he was. So that was an interesting thing to work on. That was when we started playing around with so-called artificial intelligence.
Right.
It would basically tell you random jokes. But that was good. That was a nice project.
So how long did this game take between you and Mel then? How long was it, you know, did it take in the long run?
I can't say that was a long program. I think that would have been a couple of months. It was text only, from what I remember.
Okay, then. So what was the next game then that you worked on then?
Right, after that, I seem to remember getting into contact with Codemasters, and I ported The Race Against Time. The Oliver Twins had written a game, Sport Aid, I'm not sure if that was the name of it.
Right. Well, why don't you tell us then, how did you get in contact with Codemasters? Did you contact them? Did they support you?
Yeah, again, I must have had a couple of calling cards, unreleased games that I'd send to companies. And there was this... At the time, there was always an opportunity. There was always an opportunity that there was something that needed to be done. So I ported over this Race Against Time game to the Commodore 64. And through that then, there must have been some sort of mutual trust, a relationship developing, and that led to Rockstar Ate My Hamster, which was the following game.
Which was the one of my favourite games ever. I absolutely loved that game. But we'll go on to that in a little bit then. So how did you find, actually, your time working at Codemasters? Was it a different experience working for the Darlings?
Not particularly, no. I guess the thing with a conversion is that you have to get things exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have expected that porting a Spectrum game to a C64 would have been easy, but there were always these little problems. I think the Oliver Twins had this particle system, which was wonderful on their games, which you could have, let me see, effects of water and things like that, little stars which would follow a path. And yeah. I had no idea what they were doing there, and I don't think that ever got into the game. I think I faked it, basically.
Right.
But there was stuff like that. But other than that, Codemasters were very good.
So how did you find working alongside people like then, like the Oliver Twins?
It was great. It was the place to be, which I didn't know that at the time, but there was a certain leeway there. You could get away with a lot of stuff, and eventually they'd let you do what you wanted to do.
So they really allowed you to be very creative and just do things on your own, I guess.
And to be fair, they would look after you financially. They would give you advance. They would give you advances for writing a game. That was I'd never had that before.
So what sort of advance did you get then, like for Rockstar at my house?
Thousands of pounds.
But, wow.
Actually, thousands of pounds before. I may be looking back through rose-tinted spectacles, but it, from what I remember, thousands of pounds before, I must have just had the title and the idea.
Yeah.
I remember going up to Codemasters, because I never actually physically worked in Codemasters, but I remember going up for a meeting and... given the games that Codemasters were putting out at the time, but they had the Dizzy games, but they also did the skateboard simulators and the skiing simulators and things like that.
Oh, they had thousands of simulators. That's what Codemasters sort of thrived on, simulators.
I thought, well, I've got this idea for a Rockstar management game. I don't know that a company like Codemasters would be interested, but well, I've got their phone number, so why don't I give them a sales pitch.
But how did you come up with this idea, though? Like, Rockstar, I mean, it's so good. It's ingenious. Honestly, it's just one of the best ideas for a game, which I think still has aged fantastically, and I still play it to this day all the time. I mean, where were you sitting? I mean, were you watching a rock concert? How did you come up with this, like, amazing idea?
Oh, I just thought, why hasn't anyone... There was Football Manager games.
Yeah.
Why does no one do... It's a much more colourful industry, I thought. There would be scope for an entertaining game there. I can't remember. I think that the thing... I'd had this idea of a management game, a Rockstar management game, and I think what sold it was the title, basically.
Yeah, Rockstar at my hands. I love it.
And I thought they'll never go with that. It'll be Rockstar Manager Simulator or something. But again, to be fair... They loved it, and they were willing to take a chance. They got me some. The graphics artist was fabulous.
Who worked out on the graphics actually on that? Let's have a little look. Who did you have? You had Chris Graham working on that.
Chris Graham
And Paul Healy, I believe.
Yeah. So the caricatures of the rock stars. That was Chris, who seemed to come out of nowhere, like myself, really. From what I remember, he was living in Liverpool.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I was talking to Richard and David, I'd like some good caricatures of rock stars, because if we're going to do this, there's no point having rubbish graphics. And Richard or David said, we've got just the fella, we got just the guy. And I don't know how I saw his work. He must have done a couple of caricatures, and I knew that he was perfect. On a spectrum, I don't think you could have surpassed him. I don't think you could have had better graphics.
I mean, I'm looking at a screenshot now of the manager. You've got the two guys. You've got the older fella and the younger guy. I mean, who exactly were these characters based on then? So let's reveal all then.
Let me see. Now, if you look at it today, you'd swear that one of them was Simon Cowell.
That's what I always thought. I always thought the younger one was Simon Cowell.
He hadn't gone to the global swing at that point. I think... that the actual manager was loosely based, I had no say in this at all, I think it was loosely based on a newspaper tycoon.
Right.
Who is no longer with us.
Right, I think I know, yep.
And the other guy, I have no idea. You probably have to ask Chris about that.
It does look like Simon Cowell for all these years. I always thought, was this based on Simon? Was this how Simon got into the record business by starring in this game?
I guess it was the other way around. I think Simon Cowell must have been playing Rockstar Ate My Hamster, and he must have seen himself on the screen, and that changed his life forever.
Well, I think this is how he came up with the X Factor idea, by playing this game.
No! Don't put that on me!
I can't. You could make a sequel to this, Rockstar at my X Factor or something like that.
Yes, I must do that.
Right, so who came up with the idea of which characters to use and which parodies, and how did you get away with it?
Yeah, I was very innocent. I was very naive at the time, and I had no idea that this. I didn't think this would even be a concern. If a company was willing to go with Rockstar Eat My Hamster, I thought, well, that's fine. I'll just take the Mickey out of all these rock stars. I guess they would. I seem to remember one conversation with the Darling Brothers where they'd had some advice that it was okay. It was we could do this because it was in the tradition of satire.
Yeah,
and either no one legally could sue you for this, or if somebody did, that would put them in a pretty bad light, that they couldn't really take a joke.
Because you actually had loads of sort of noticeable characters. You had like Elton John, you had Michael Jackson, Tina Turner, you had all these characters that were instantly recognizable. And every time I played that, I was wowed by it. I was wowed by the humour of the game.
Yeah, I wouldn't dare do it these days. Honestly, I don't think the culture would take it.
I think it would work well, actually. I think people would see the funny side of it and people would actually enjoy that. So what else? How did you go about this then? How did you go about adding these rock elements to this pretty much football-style manager-type game?
Yeah, what did it take to become not a successful rock star? I think that was not the point, really, but what would it take to become a successful rock manager? Mm-hmm. And the rock stars were a commodity that you should use, and you should weigh up how popular they were. There was an element of that, how good they were musically as well, which perhaps that probably wouldn't ring true to life for a manager would be going for the most popular.
Because the amount of times I played this game and you had the headlines, which was like a newspaper, very similar to The Sun, and it would be like, you know, Rockstar overdoses or Rockstar does this.
Yes.
You know, your band member has left. And you had to spoil them as well. And it was just so many little touches that just made this game so playable. I think every time I played this game, I always overspent because I thought I'd give them sort of like amazing lights and something in the background, and I catered for my rock star. It's just simply superb. It's just it's in my top 10 games ever, definitely.
Well, thanks. You had to treat some, there was an ego factor involved that you had to treat some rock stars. Some rock stars, you could do what you wanted with them. They were no longer popular, and they would take anything. They take very small wages, and they would expect nothing in return except just to get on stage and perform. And of course, you had musical ability as well, that some of them perhaps weren't as gifted.
So how do you go about programming this sort of thing that you just described there? Because it sounds really complicated, actually, and especially when you consider it's just on a ZX Spectrum.
Yeah, I guess it was. It was all these little variables that you'd have from 0 to 255, how there was a popularity variable, there was a musical ability variable, and there'd be some sort of algorithm that would juggle all these numbers around. That would determine how many records you'd sell, but you needed to get the budget. So there was a way of the program would work out how many tickets you could sell at a certain price in a certain venue. Right. Yeah, I guess it was quite quite tricky, quite complicated in a way.
Yeah, I think it's still one of the most polished games that I've actually played on the ZX Spectrum. Holds up to this day, absolutely amazing. It's got an amazing soundtrack, and I like the name of all the little songs, and the fact that you could actually pick and choose the name of the songs and change the name of your group or your supergroup, whoever you chose to do.
Yes, it's surprisingly popular today. I did a Google search, and it is surprisingly popular.
Now, speaking about popularity, wasn't this game actually in the top 100 in the US Rockstar-type games?
Yeah. Long after I'd left the industry, Rolling Stone magazine ran the 50 best rock and roll video games of all time.
Okay, yeah, top 50, yeah.
Yeah. I'm guessing that it was quite difficult to find 50 rock and roll related video games. I'm guessing that anyone who'd had a video game with a connection to music would have been in that 50. But to be fair, there it was. Surprising because the game never reached America.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say to you. The game didn't come out in the US, and for it to be in this chart, it's just unbelievable. The testament to the success of the game.
Yeah, yeah.
So what did the Darlins actually think of this game? What was the feedback that you got from them and, you know, the other people at Codemasters?
The feedback? I mean, I'm sure they made sure it was polished. I'm sure there were things that they would suggest to me that I'd put in the game. The feedback was extremely positive. I imagined that the game would come out as the standard Codemasters budget range, which would have been $199 or $299. But it turned out that they liked the game so much that they put it out as, I think, their second Codemasters Gold game, which, from what I remember, was something like £13. It was a huge leap in price from the standard games to the gold games. It was released, first of all, a nice cardboard box with stickers and a badge. What else do we have? Oh, and the Stun newspaper, which got the game banned. That was...
Really?
That was the downfall, my downfall.
What happened there? Sorry, if you don't mind me asking.
Yeah, no, that's okay. We had a little newspaper, a mock-up newspaper inside with some articles and a TV guide, cartoons, etc. And there were some jokes in it that one father whose son had bought the game took objection to one particular joke and walked into his local branch of a chain store and said, "I think you should remove this game from your shelves." They had a look at the game and they thought it was corrupting to the younger generation. It was a strange situation because they would be selling pornography and firearms magazines, but this computer game should not be on show. And there was a few. I seem to remember a couple of weeks. Another store followed suit, and there were a couple of weeks where they really had no policy on the game. It had just been removed from the stores. I tried to find out. I walked into the local shop and I said, "Could I get this game, please?" And I got the response, "No, we're not allowed to sell it to you, but if you ask us nicely, we can sell it to you under the counter."
Right.
So an illicit game.
You know what? I think that it sounds even more rock and roll like, actually. Buying Rockstar at my hamster, you know, for a little under-the-counter type thing.
Yeah, but we missed the big sales period. That was the thing.
So how did Codemasters feel about all this that actually happened then?
Codemasters could handle anything. They were so professional. They would just deal with stuff. I look to them now, if ever there is a problem, I looked at the way that they would react, and they would just go through stuff to get things done. What happened then, they had to reprint the insert, a single sheet insert with a little note at the bottom of the insert, where if you wanted the original mock-up newspaper, you could write to Codemasters, and I think you'd probably send a stamped addressed envelope, and they would send you a copy of it. I think that's how they got around it in the end.
Right, fantastic. Now, I'm just looking here on the website, World of Spectrum, and it says that to promote the launch, Codemasters and the Sun staged a competition, and the 10 runners-up received a special edition of the game called Rockstar Goes Bizarre.
Yes, something that I found hard to believe at the time. I was surprised not only that the Sun newspaper would be interested in the game, but that they would take the game with its Stun packaging, and we produced a version with the Sun.
Wow.
And we had, at the time, there was a column in the Sun called Bizarre.
Yeah.
And the writer of the column was Piers Morgan.
Wow, okay.
And he ended up in Rockstar Goes Bizarre as Piers Morgan, I believe.
Really? Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's my claim to fame. So did we add a couple of characters? I think we may have added some characters as well. And basically, we just replaced the Stun, all the references to the Stun newspaper, with the Sun newspaper, and changed the title.
Now, have you got like a mock-up of this, of the Stun newspaper at all? Did you ever manage to get one?
Yeah, I got a couple of copies of the final game. It was very heavily limited edition. The packaging was just redone with all the Stuns changed to Sun.
Fantastic, absolutely fantastic then. So, have you actually gone back and played Rockstar at My Hamster at all?
Not for 20 years.
Years, wow. You would actually find that it's still as good as it was back then. I mean, like, I must play this game at least once every 2 weeks because it's just so
Yeah, but
I love it, basically.
I didn't. If I went back and if I did think it was good, what have I done with my life, you know?
Right. But you have made some other classics as well. We'll move on to the next one, which was Slightly Magic. Now, why don't you tell us about Slightly Magic?
What I'd realised at that time was, through the Oliver Twins, if you had a successful in-game character, mm-hmm. you could develop entertaining games based around characters rather than particular types of game.
Yeah.
What you should do is look at a game and develop it from a character's point of view. And from that, you'd get, the world would appear, you'd know what to do, basically. Mm-hmm. So I took, again, a couple of characters up to Codemasters and we went through them. And Slightly just came out on top.
Yeah.
The Dizzy games were very popular at the time, so Codemasters knew that this sort of graphic adventure game, the little cartoon adventure game, would work. And Slightly as a character we went for because he could change his form and he could have different abilities depending on what form he took. So he could become a bird and a fish, mm-hmm. and that would open up the gameplay a lot.
So how did you go about writing the story? How did you come up with the idea for Slightly?
Slightly, you just get characters just appear. And he was there one morning. That's the way things work. Mm-hmm. If you look around for something, there they are. So I knew that was a little wizard. A strange time before Harry Potter.
Yeah, definitely.
There's another one. We've Simon Cowell.
And then Harry Potter.
anyway. And that would, the dragons would, you had to have little dragons and you had to have a magic cat and wizards and witches and everything just made itself visible. I thought, wouldn't it be great if you could have a game where you would have spells rather than just picking up stuff and dropping it down here? You could make up spells and then you had to have a spell duel at the end of the game. You'd duel with probably a witch, was it? I can't remember. Probably a witch at the end, that you'd have to change your form into a creature that would be bigger or smarter or faster mm-hmm. than your opponents.
Now, I remember playing this game, and I was a big fan of the whole cartoon adventures, mm-hmm. you know, the Dizzy games. And one of the things that struck me about this game was the main character. Like you said, it's a very noticeable character. It's a little wizard, but it's very cute. And it's just the way it works on the screen. It's a very colourful-looking game.
Yeah.
The puzzles weren't too overly complicated, I don't think, if memory serves me right. They were nice and simple. It had a nice sort of progression sort of type.
Progression, that was very important. I think the first puzzle, you could see the solution, but you couldn't actually get to it on the first screen. So it was clear what you had to do, but you had to lure people into the game. You had to make it semi-obvious, but then how would I be able to get there? Mm-hmm. You start off with a simple puzzle, as you know, and then you build it to get people interested, and then you get rewards for playing it more. So you have to get something concrete out of these things, otherwise there's no point playing them.
So what was the reaction to this game from people like the Oliver Twins or the Darlings?
Again, nothing but positive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what they wanted. That was the product they wanted to put out. That would do the job.
Now, the other thing I remember as well, it had a really nice catchy tune, which was actually done by Alistair Brimble.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get him on board of actually making this game then, doing the music?
Now, Alistair, it's difficult to remember. I think Alistair worked on Rockstar mm-hmm. with another musician. Time-wise, I went on to work with Alistair on one of his CDs. I wrote the concept for Bang Tick Tick, I think that was the CD.
Right.
So I don't know. We just got on. Alistair did the music. I don't know. Yes.
There was meant to be a follow up to Slightly Magic, which was called A Slightly Spooky. What happened with that then?
Indeed, there was a follow up to Slightly Magic, which got finished. Now, I think it was finished on the Amiga and the Atari ST. I'm not completely reliable on this, but Slightly Spooky.
So, what was this game like? Was it exactly the same sort of thing with 16-bit style graphics, new puzzles,
yes.
new transformations, new spells, etc.?
Yes, that was it. It was the same game. Part 2. Slightly Magic Part 2. That's what you did.
It's a real shame that this game never got released, because I never knew about this up until one of our community members posted a question on the forum for you.
Yeah.
He said, how come Slightly Spooky? Why didn't that come out? I thought, Slightly Spooky? There was another one?
Yes. Why did that not come out? The games industry in the UK just seemed to implode at that point. So apparently, I read somewhere that Codemasters had a couple of dozen games or something that never saw the light of day.
Right, okay. So they're probably still lurking around on, you know, on the shelf somewhere, just waiting for someone to actually give them a go, I guess. Right, so where did you go then after the whole Slightly Spooky situation?
Yeah, it became obvious that if Codemasters couldn't release a game, if they didn't think it was a goer, if they didn't think that they could make a living out of it, that was it. You'd be wasting your time. I guess I could have gone to work for a large company, a games company, and I guess over the years I'd have seen one games company dissolving, and I could have jumped ship to another larger games company, and then jumped to another iceberg, and to another iceberg. But they were all contracting; they were all melting, and it was time to move on. And then, of course, I knew nothing. I completely left the industry. I had no connection with it, and I had no idea that these games were still being talked about, let alone played even.
Yeah, that's got to be, like, so surprising for you, actually. I mean, how do you feel that some of these games that you made all these years ago, people still play them to this day and look at them fondly?
Yeah, that's very strange. I was thinking before, a couple of days ago, about doing this podcast that I tend not to look back. I'm always looking to the next, what I'm going to do next, the next project. So it's... Come on, guys, haven't you got anything better to do? Aren't there anything? There must be stuff. there must be better games around these days. Come on.
I think it all goes back to sort of like the child nostalgic thing, where you've got all your modern games. It's too much. When you go back to these games, it takes us back to a simpler time, I guess.
They were better games, I can say that. There was more originality, and they could be quirky. That's probably the all I should say about it. They could, you had people involved that are not involved in the industry today.
Yeah.
They would do stuff that you don't need to be technologically advanced to make a good game.
Right, so let's, you know, move forward to nowadays, basically. The next project you've got is a Potassium Frog.
Yes, Potassium Frog. It must be about 2 years ago now, how I had not realized that I could get to do it again, because possibly there was a window 10 years ago when I could have started writing games again. I don't know, because I didn't think about doing it. But it became blindingly obvious to me that things had gone full circle, that people like myself could actually go back to the computer in the bedroom and churn something out. You didn't need anyone else. You could just push it out and see what happened.
Why don't you tell us about the game that you've actually been working on the iPhone, and it's actually available on the App Store itself?
As we speak, yes. Clockwork the Mouse is the game, and the character, again, I had a couple of options when I decided, it must have been the iPad. It must have been the iPad when I picked up an iPad, and the closeness of it, the way that you could interact with it, it became a slightly different thing. That it would be perfect. What if somebody could write a game for this, that you could tilt it and you touch the screen, you're almost in the game.
Yeah.
So close. And because of that, I thought, well, 20 years is not a long time. I realized, again, with having children, that things, when they're playing video games, there's a fair bit I could tell them about it, if you like. And things hadn't really changed. That was the surprising thing, which is a little disheartening in a way, that the games haven't changed. There's nothing really new. And again, that makes me sound a little old, but that's the way it is. Anyway, I thought I could go at this in a couple of ways. Should I go down the Rockstar route?
Mm-hmm.
Should I write some sort of follow-up to Rockstar? Or should I write... my two favourite games that I've done must be Rockstar and Slightly Magic.
Yeah.
So I would follow on from that. That's all I could do. And so I followed on from Slightly Magic. And if you pick up Clockwork, you'll see it's a little character that you interact with. He became a Clockwork Mouse because I wanted you to move him by just moving your iPad or your iPhone. So a Clockwork Mouse, that would gravity would move him.
Now, I'll tell you what, I've been playing this game this morning before we did the interview, and it did feel like Slightly Magic, the way you have to do the puzzles, and it's interesting the way you actually move the little mouse, and I can see why you created him as a Clockwork Mouse, because you move him left and right by tilting the iPhone or the iPad,
yeah,
and by collecting certain objects that, again, just like in Slightly Magic, will solve puzzles to get you through to the next section.
Yeah.
But I seem to have got stuck in level two.
And you can build up speed to jump over certain things, etc., etc. Yeah, that's good. You got stuck because once you've done the game, that's it. You know how to do it. You're not going to go back to playing it. But hopefully, there's a couple of hours entertainment in there. And I thought when I decided to do it, I'd do it properly. I'd set up Potassium Frog to cover myself legally because there are quite a few people being sued for various things these days, so I didn't want to lose the house. And it would be nice to have a brand.
Yeah. That
Colin Jones is not a particularly unusual name. So I'd set up that up, and then what could I do with the game? Well, yeah, I'd have a tilt and touch, I call it, don't I? Tilt and touch adventure. But then one of the things I really got bored with the 8-bit games were the level designs. You'd have to build up your levels with building blocks, some of which would be solid and some of which would be transparent, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't be bothered, so I had to work out that I just draw the backgrounds and there'd be a rough level of, there'd be rough blocks of solidity and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the backgrounds are just hand-drawn scans, coloured in and stuff, which gives it an interesting look, I think.
I think it does. I was playing the game today and it gives that a nice sort of charm as well. And I was just thinking, it's a sort of game that my little boy would actually like playing because of the sort of like artwork style. It was automatically, he would zoom into it and really enjoy playing that.
Yeah, yeah, I've had a bit of that. The youngsters seem to go for it. And there's something about you can touch different characters and you get little responses out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And you're exploring it in a way which isn't always related to the game, if you like, but then the characters will tell you stuff. And it's just entertaining. It's a nice couple of hours, basically, when there's nothing on TV.
It's a great little game. You know, it's a nice way of you coming back into sort of like programming and mm-hmm. making these games. And the best thing is, it's only 69 pence.
Is it? Good grief. That can't be right.
Well, which is absolutely fantastic. That's when you consider most of the modern games are about £30 or £40. But that's what I love about the iPhone platform. And that's what I was going to say to you. What's your view on the programming on the iPhone platform?
I don't like the schism between casual games and real games. We've got ourselves into this. Well, not me. But they are quite creative. Some of them are very good, and you can do phenomenal things on them. You'd be surprised. I think possibly the only thing about Clockwork is that I put too much time into it. And it's
how long did this game take you then?
That took a year.
Wow.
That was a great thing to do. I thought, I'll do this game, and that'll sell, and that'll fund the next project, and then I could do something really interesting.
So the question I want to ask you then, and I'm sure everyone else wants to find out, will we see a Rockstar at My Hamster sort of sequel?
The spiritual sequel, yes. Yes. Yes, we will. I decided that, yeah.
And you're definitely, you're working on that at the moment, or it's just you're playing with Ryan with ideas at the moment?
I'm trying to get the form or the mechanisms. I'm trying to work out, I know exactly what I want to do, but it's getting that into some, I guess it's an algorithm, I guess it's some way of making it all work that you could bring in just like with Rockstar, you could bring in the idea that somebody's musical ability would matter.
Yeah.
How many fans they had would matter. How big their ego was would matter. And you can build in different things and then get some sort of way of people passing their time out of it, basically.
I'll tell you what, that sounds absolutely fantastic. And if it's anything like Rockstar at my hands, I think it will go down really, really well. Do you think it will capture the same sort of sense of humour that Rockstar had?
It would have to. It would have to. I guess that's something that I think I have to do. I can't see many people doing that sort of thing. It would be a shame if I didn't do something. You look around and I think, well, if there was a game like this, not like Rockstar, because that is, it's been done now, but if there was a game like this, well, I'd buy it.
Yeah.
I mean,
I definitely would. Thousands of people would.
Well, that would be good.
Well, hopefully this idea that you come up with, hopefully this time it won't be pinched by Simon Cowell, you know, or Piers Morgan or anyone like that.
Okay, well, they're living off my back.
They are indeed. All right, then. I'll tell you what, Colin, we'll start rounding this up. Colin, I'd like to thank you for taking the time for doing this podcast. It really means a lot, and I'm sure all our listeners are going to absolutely love hearing all your gaming memories.
Well, thanks. It's been a pleasure. A nice way to spend an hour. Thanks.
So thanks very much for listening, guys, and we'll see you next time with more Retro Asylum Podcast.
Just say no.